This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It's spring in the Northern Hemisphere, and you know what that means? The robins are back, the geese, and all the other birds are migrating back from their winter feeding grounds. But along the way, as many as 2,400 of them could meet an untimely end by hitting airplanes this year. That's how many bodies my next guest received between April and June in her lab last year. Yes, Carla Dove collects bodies of birds. Well, she actually collects the remains. Sometimes they're just the feather fragments and smashed tissue. The technical term is snarge. And that's right. My next guest deals with the casualties of bird-plane collisions, trying to identify what species they once were, because airlines, the military, and others want to know what species are most likely to fly in front of a plane. Maybe we can use that knowledge to prevent those species from hanging out near airports, or at least build aircraft that can withstand those collisions. Behind the scenes of all this is Carla Dove, a forensic ornithologist and program manager of the Feather Identification Lab at the Smithsonian here in Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before everybody does it, let me ask you about...
Yes, that's my name.
Working with birds. Do you have a no special love for the dove or the pigeon or
yes.
that family?
Well, actually, the only time that ever became a specific problem was when I was trying to decide on what project to work on for my PhD thesis. And my advisor said, whatever you do, you cannot select the family Columbidae with doves and pigeons because you'll never live it down.
Well, but Dr. Dove fits right in.
Yeah, that's the way they remember my name. So whatever works.
That's what I say, you know. Is your work anything like CSI ornithology? I mean, you collect. How did you come up with that name? What is it?
The snarge?
The snarge.
Oh, yeah. Well, snarge is a term that we have always used at the museum and the prep lab where we skin birds. And we have a lot of bird ick laying on the table. And so when we started working on bird strike identifications, that was sort of a natural word to use for that case. It's bird ick. Snarge came from the prep lab at the Smithsonian, but we sort of claimed it as our term now.
So it's forensic. What does that mean?
It is in a way. I mean, it's not technically forensic because we don't do law enforcement cases, but we do use forensic techniques. And so we look at the trace evidence, we look at the microscopic characters, the DNA, the circumstantial evidence to solve our puzzle, which is ultimately the identification of the species of bird.
So if you're going to identify them, then you must keep samples of birds to match with.
Yes.
How many birds are in your collection?
Well, actually, we are located right upstairs in the National Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian in the bird division. And the bird division was founded way before there were ever airplanes flying. And so we are just a user of that huge collection there. But that is our resource and our research collection. So we have somewhere around 620,000 museum specimens up there in the drawers.
Wow.
We represent about 85% of the diversity of birds of the world, and so it is an ideal place to conduct this kind of research.
So how many birds actually get hit by planes or vice versa?
Yeah, that's right. The birds aren't actually flying into the planes. It's not their fault. But we, you know, every year our lab identifies over 9,000 cases. And you mentioned at the beginning of the show that we do about 2,400 in spring migration. But totally for the year, it's over 9,000 samples that we receive. Now, we don't receive all of the samples. So there are somewhere around 13,000 bird strikes reported to civil aviation and another 4,000 to 5,000 from the military. So it's quite a few birds every year.
So who picks up these samples? How does a sample get to you?
Yeah, it's taken some time, but we've got people trained in the field now. The military has a bird aircraft strike hazard team that will pick up the remains. The civil aviation have biologists on the airports that pick up remains and send them to us.
And so how often do you have a completely unsolved mystery? Lot of times?
No, not really. We have great tools to do the work. So we have DNA and we have microscope analysis, and we also use whole feathers. And so about 98% of the time we get it to some level.
Wow.
You know, we say it's a duck, but we can't say it's a mallard or pintail. And a few times, if it's just a piece of black feather with no characters or no pattern or no microscopic diagnostic characters, then we just have to say it's a bird.
How small a piece of feather do you need? And what part?
Well, sometimes we can do it with a single, just a single barb from the fluffy part of the feather, and that's the base of the feather, the part of the feather that is responsible for insulation and keeping the bird warm. That's where the real diagnostic characters are located. So we need that part, but we don't need very much.
If somebody sends you some snarge, let's say, and you analyze it, do you ever say, hey, this isn't a bird? I got somebody sent me something. What is it?
Well, if we get that, somebody's going to get an earful. Because we, you know, we are very serious about what we do. We don't want people sending us jokes, but we do get things that are interesting, that are valid.
Tell me.
Like fish. And
fish?
Yeah. And deer. And
wait. Back up. How does a deer get on a plane? And don't say they buy a ticket.
We do get snakes, too.
How?
Well, the interesting thing is, and it all turns out to be pretty much the same story, is it's usually a bird was either feeding on that animal or the bird was carrying it in its talons, and it just, you know, when it hits the plane, everything goes everywhere, and that's the part of the sample that we receive. And so, yeah.
Interesting. I know that your team worked on the aftermath of that crash that led to the so-called miracle on the Hudson, the plane that landed in the river. Was it any mystery that the plane had hit geese, though? I mean,
well, that's a good question, because they did. The pilot, I think, reported geese, and they did think that's what it was, right, initially in the very beginning of the investigation. We had to confirm that for several reasons. One reason is that there is another bird that looks very similar to a Canada goose in New York called a brant, and that bird weighs significantly less. It's a 3 to 4 pound bird. And the engines on that aircraft were designed to take a 3 to 4 pound bird and keep on functioning. And so the engineers were very concerned in that case about what the exact species of bird was to get the weight, the average weight on that. And so when we decided and determined it was Canada goose, they were relieved to know that an 8 pound bird, a 10 pound bird, is not supposed to go through their engines and keep on, and the engine's not supposed to keep on working. So that was part of it. And then, you know, we want to know the exact species. So, as you said in the beginning of the program, so that we can know what that bird eats and why is it there and when is it there and what potential problems could it cause. And then you can go out onto the airfield and do something.
What do you do? If you know there's a bird hazard, what can you do at an airport?
There's a lot of things that you can do. You know, there are border collies that keep certain birds away. There are peregrine falcons or other falcons that can be trained. Sometimes it's as simple as cutting the grass.
So you take away their nesting.
You take away, you know, if they wanted to have a flat area where they can go and look around and see predators coming their way, and let the grass grow a little bit, and they don't feel comfortable there anymore.
Just the opposite.
Yeah, but on the other hand, if you know, there's tall grass and there's lots of little mice and different kinds of rodents burrowing around in there, and the hawks are going to come to hunt and feed there. So you have to know the problem on the specific airfield, and that's where the species identification comes in.
Now, I know you've been doing this for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
Have you noticed a change at all in the patterns of bird strikes or anything over time?
Yes, we have. And that's also another interesting question, because now we're seeing things, some distributions of birds are changing. And for example, the black vulture used to be a bird that was always in the south and never really got that far north. And now more and more we're seeing those in bird strikes from northern states. And so over time, bird distributions change. We don't know why or what's the cause of it, but we can just see those kinds of things in our data.
Does anybody, they know that you're a forensic ornithologist who deal with birds. Does anybody ever send you stuff that may have a bird in it? Wants an identification of what, you know, maybe it's an animal has swallowed it or something like that.
Yes, we worked on a project, and in fact, we're still involved in it, with Everglades National Park biologists on identifying the prey remains of the Burmese python. And so the pythons are wreaking havoc down there. They're non-native species, and they're eating birds. And of course, you know, once you get the stomach contents of a Burmese python, it's not going to be the most pleasant thing you want to see in the morning.
I'll bet.
But the snake DNA will overtake the sample, and so it's very difficult to get DNA from material
That's
like that. And so we're using the morphological characters of the bones and the feathers and the microscopic characters of the feathers to help us determine the species that they're eating.
Let me see if I get a quick call in from Dylan in California. Hi, welcome. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, I'm in the Air Force, and so I've actually sent some samples to Carla as part of the safety team. So first of all, I just want to say thank you for your work.
Thank you.
And then, so my question was, with the samples that we sent in were international, and I was wondering how long those take to get to you guys and if they have any smells or anything weird by the time they get to you.
Mm. Thank you.
Almost all of them have some kind of smell. But
getting
yes.
through customs, they have to go through customs?
Oh, they have to go through customs, and we have to have all kinds of special permits to, you know, to allow them to export and us to import, and they have to be treated so that we're not importing diseases or different kinds of viruses. So all of that procedure has been worked out, but it does take a little bit longer for us to get samples from overseas, and we do realize that the Air Force has a 30-day turnaround time, so we do try to put those up to the head of the line.
Do you get a call from an airport, let's say like JFK, which has a lot of stuff, and says, we don't know what this is, but it may be heading, it may be for you, because we've sent other bird stuff to you.
Yes,
come and
we
pick
do.
It up. You
yeah,
know?
They definitely give us a heads up, especially if they're sending something priority that has caused damage or something that they would really like to know about. JFK is very good about reporting bird strikes.
Well, they certainly live in the neighborhood.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
It's a sanctuary there. Thank you, Dr. Dove.
Thank you.
Dr. Carla Dove, Program Manager of the Feather Identification Lab. I'll bet you never knew they had one until today at the Smithsonian Institution here in Washington. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, how you can protect your privacy from your internet service provider and who can legally sell your browsing data. So you want to know about privacy? We're going to have some tips. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Earlier this month, President Trump signed legislation rolling back FCC rules issued last year on internet privacy, blocking those privacy rules before they could even take effect. Under the law, internet service providers are now allowed to sell your browsing data, your record of what sites you visited online. But what if you don't want them to? What tools can help you keep your data and your browsing habits private? And what about messaging your friends? How can you keep those conversations away from prying eyes? Joining me to talk about practical tips for privacy are Julia Angwin. She's a senior reporter at ProPublica and has written extensively about security and privacy. She's the author of Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and in a World of Relentless Surveillance. She's in our New York studios. Welcome back.
It's great to be here.
Also, Eva Galperin is Director of Cybersecurity for the Electronic Frontier Foundation and helped create their surveillance self-defense guide. And she's at KQED in San Francisco. We'll get to her in a minute. Welcome to Science Friday, Eva.
Thanks. I'm glad. Happy to be here.
And nice to have you, Julie. How much does this new law actually change things?
Well, unfortunately, this new law actually just sort of codifies the status quo, which is that internet service providers, the companies that you pay for internet service, whether it's on your phone or on your home internet connection, have been desperate to get into the business that Google and Facebook have of creating dossiers about people and getting advertisers to pay for that access. So they've been coming up with new products to sell to advertisers for years now, and the FCC effort last year to put in these privacy rules was actually because they were concerned about the intrusiveness of the actions the ISPs were taking, and it was meant to curtail some of that. But now this new administration and Congress have said, actually, Go wild, have fun, and enter this new era of access to personal data.
So what kind of data are we talking about? What are they able to see?
So basically, your ISP sees everything. So you connect to the internet through them, and then basically the rest of the internet, as you access it, they can see it, unless you're using some kind of masking technique. You know, generally, if you're using most email providers at this point, their back end the part that goes over the ISP is encrypted, so they mostly can't read your email, but that's still not true of all of them. Same thing with instant messaging or chats. So, you know, theoretically, they can see almost everything unless the service you're using has taken steps to encrypt it.
Mm-hmm. And Eva Galperin, is there anything a person can do?
Well, there are a couple of different things that you can do. The first is to think about using a VPN when you connect online. And not all VPNs are created equal, and I would be very suspicious of free VPNs or VPNs that are very cheap, because usually if you don't understand who is paying for the product, you are probably the service.
So how much should you pay, reasonably pay, for a VPN, a virtual private network?
I think it really depends, but if it is free, or if it is, say, $20 for a lifetime membership, you should be strongly suspicious that they are making money by selling your browser data.
Yeah, so maybe $3, $4, $5 a month or something like that is a good price.
That's not unreasonable.
Now, how do you decide what you need to include in the mix of your protections?
Well, again, you might want to consider using a VPN, mm-hmm. But you might also want to make sure that you're using a browser extension called HTTPS Everywhere, which is written by EFF and which we make available for free. You can use it on either your Chrome or your Firefox browser, and it will make sure that if the site that you're visiting supports HTTPS, that it will do so by default. So HTTPS is the encryption that Julio was talking about, which means that your ISP can see sort of what website you're going to, but they can't see what you're doing on the website, and they can't see what part of the website they're going to. So if you go to, say, kqed.org, they can see that you went to kqed.org, but they can't see that you went to kqed.org/Science Friday.
So people like to talk about the NSA or hackers as being something they were really afraid of, but you're saying probably a bigger threat is the ISP, your service provider.
I think everybody's threat model is a little bit different, and some people are genuinely concerned about being spied on by law enforcement. But that doesn't mean that being spied on by your ISP or by corporations is not also deeply worrying for some people, and mm-hmm. they should be able to protect themselves against it.
Mm-hmm. Julia, what else do you do to shield yourself?
Well, I'm a big fan of the Tor web browser. So it's a web browser you download just like any other one, but it anonymizes your traffic. So what your ISP would see is that you're going through Tor, but it wouldn't know what websites you're visiting. And it's probably, in my opinion, the best protection we have in the situation that we're in, where the ISPs have been given carte blanche to look at everything that we're doing online. And so there's a little lag time because Tor bounces your traffic around the world. So it goes to Amsterdam or, you know, Germany or wherever. And so in order to evade, you know, being seen. And so you have to put up with a little bit of slowness. But I keep it open most of the time and try to use it for the searches that I don't want anyone to see.
Don't the browsers, some of the web browsers have it built right in, some of the VPNs and Tors built in, or you have to add that on?
Usually you download it yourself. Yeah. I would definitely prefer people to download it directly from Tor, because there also are, unfortunately, people who try to market fake Tor browsers. So it's best to get it directly from the source.
Eva, you wanted to
jump in there? One thing to keep in mind if you're using Tor browser for all of your browsing is that you will frequently get a lot of requests to fill out CAPTCHAs and prove that you are not a bot. And one of the reasons for this is because a lot of abuse to websites happens via Tor, and so they need to make sure that that you are not, in fact, being abusive, that you're just like a regular people surfing the internet. So it slows you down a little bit, and it's a little bit annoying, but it is free, and it's certainly worthwhile.
And what about text messaging? What's the best way to feel like you're secure in text messaging?
Well, the first thing that you should know is that if you are sending just regular straight-up SMS text messages to someone from your phone to their phone, that it is extremely easy to spy on those messages, not just the metadata, who you're talking to, but the content of your messages is really easy to pick up, not just for your cell phone provider, but for anyone who can make a GNU radio to spy on your text messaging for, honestly, not a lot of money. So text messages are not very secure. There are several excellent replacements for text messaging that work quite well. One of them is Signal from OpenWhisper Systems, which is both free and open source. And it works as a pretty good way of sending messages to your friends. The same crypto is used in WhatsApp. The only concern about WhatsApp is that WhatsApp is owned by Facebook, and so Facebook takes their knowledge of who you're sending messages to and combines it with the things they know about you from Facebook, which, if you're worried about corporate spying, could be pretty distressing. I also recommend Wire, which is also a free app.
Isn't the Apple system, the text message system, encrypted end-to-end?
Yes, if you're sending messages to other people who have iPhones.
Aha. So it has to have... So if you send somebody who's on Google or that other system, Android, then that it's only going to be encrypted on your end, but not the other end.
It will, in fact, not be encrypted at all.
At all?
Nope.
Wow, I didn't know that. Julia, what about internet companies that aren't ISPs, like the Facebooks and the Googles? I mean... Shouldn't we just assume that that you give them permission to go and see everything that you have?
I mean, yes, if you bother to read that very long terms of service that no one ever reads, you have agreed to give them everything, and they are using that to make a lot of money off of you. And basically what's happening is that the ISPs are just jealous. They want that same amount of money. Even though they already charge you for their services. So they want sort of a double dip on that. And I think that we have to think about this as a problem overall for the internet, right? This is troubling that the ISPs got this special pass, but we've also built a system where we've allowed everyone kind of total surveillance of us. And we don't have a lot of options as consumers for a better way, you know, unless you want to do like I do, which is use Tor. But as Ava said, it's extremely annoying to use.
With the new regulations or the non-implementation of the old regulation allowing people to sell your data about where you're surfing, how granular can that get? Can they actually do companies who are buying it really want to know the exact person on the other end, or do they want to know a general rule about who?
That's a good question, because actually some of the ISPs have come out and said, we're not going to sell your browsing data. And there's a little bit of a semantic game that's going on right now, because most companies don't sell it like, here's where Ira went today and here's a list of the URLs. It's actually much more about like, I want to reach somebody who's really into science and has a radio show on Fridays, and can you follow that person around the web? And so they put people into categories and they sell those categories, and that allows them to say that they're not selling your individual data, that it's more sort of compiled or an analysis. But in reality, you know, there may well just be only one person who fits that criteria.
Mm-hmm. See if go to the phones. Let's go to Mike in New Britain, Connecticut. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hey, love your show. Great topic.
Thank you.
I heard about what happened with Congress, and I just wanted to call in. I actually purchased a VPN service. It was recommended for 2 years by PC Magazine, and they're having a 72% off deal for 2 years right now. So if anyone's out there and they're looking for it, there's NordVPN, which is truly outstanding. One other thing with the VPN services is some of them will save your data, and actually there can be a way that even though they're protecting you while you're surfing, the data is saved, and people can get at it. Some don't save the data, so there's really no way anyone can get at, you know, your information, your personal information, or your browsing history or anything like that. So I just wanted to chime in with that there's this great product, NordVPN. I don't work for them, and they're having a great sale right now.
All right. Thanks for that. Now, Eva, what do you think?
Well, I do think it's very important when you're choosing a VPN to see whether or not they have a policy of logging your browsing data. If you are concerned about your ISP having a great big, you know, log of all of your browsing data and possibly selling it, then that concern also extends to your VPN provider. You're essentially just sort of moving the nexus of trust. One of the things that I recommend doing is actually looking for a VPN provider in a country like Sweden or Finland, where logging is illegal.
Oh, Switzerland, right? something. Oh, that's so search for one that's out of the country. Well, do your homework and find out where the countries most respect your privacy and go look for a VPN there. And they're available quite easily if you Google it.
Yes, they are.
Hi. Is this the new normal now, Julia? I mean, is it this spy versus spy like we used to say in Mad Magazine? I mean, are we, you know, who's one step ahead of you, or are you one step ahead of them?
I mean, it is unfortunately the new normal, and I wish it wasn't, because the truth is that as citizens, we're always going to be outgunned, right, by the corporations that are trying to watch us and make money off of surveilling us. And so, yes, we can try to do all this. And I use a VPN and use Tor and use Signal and I use all those things. But in the end, you know, I'm up against people who have just much greater resources. And I would really love it if at some point, you know, we were able to rebalance this equation slightly more in favor of the citizen.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about your internet security with Eva Galperin. She's Director of Cybersecurity for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And also with us is Julia Angwin, Senior Reporter at ProPublica. Let's talk in the few minutes we have remaining about encrypting your email. Is that a good idea? Or is your email really so easy to get a hold of?
Well, there are sort of two aspects to encryption here, and this is actually something that confuses people a lot when they talk about encryption. They're trying to choose tools and they're trying to decide, what do I do in order to protect myself? People say, well, why don't we just sprinkle some encryption on that? Everything will be fine. And frequently, it's not clear whether they mean encrypting your data at rest or encrypting your data in transit, which are two different things. Right now, most email providers will encrypt your data in transit, which means that if you go to the URL bar on your browser, your URL will be starting with HTTPS rather than HTTP, and that means that the data is encrypted while it is going across the internet. And this is very good. This is something that we've actually been pushing for at EFF for many years, and about half of the internet is currently using HTTPS. So we think that's really great. But the other question is your data at rest, which is to say that when the email is on your computer, is it encrypted then? And for that, you often need to use additional tools such as PGP.
Pretty good privacy, as they used to call it.
Pretty good privacy.
Is it free like it used to be, or you pay for something?
Yes, it is in fact free to PGP encrypt your email. And you can do this using some browser extensions such as Mailvelope are compatible with your web-based email. So if you want to do that, you can do it. I usually caution people against the use of PGP because it is so easy to get it wrong. And when it fails unencrypted. So if
you just told us to use it. Wait. So what should you use instead?
It is extremely important that you do it right. If it is important to you to send messages back and forth with someone and you would like to make it more difficult for you to screw up, I would recommend a tool more like Signal or WhatsApp, depending on your feelings about the metadata issue, because that stuff will always be end-to-end encrypted. Your data will always be encrypted both in transit and at rest, and you can't screw it up.
Yeah, making things less easy to screw up, always the preferred situation.
Absolutely.
Certainly for people working high-tech stuff on the internet. I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us today. Eva Galperin is Director of Cybersecurity for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and she helped create their surveillance self-defense guide. And Julia Angwin, Senior Reporter at ProPublica, author of Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. Thanks to both of you for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We're going to take a break. When we come back, NPR science journalist Richard Harris is going to come and talk about how sloppy science creates worthless cures, crushes hope, and wastes billions. It's all in Rigor Mortis, his new book. We'll be back with Richard after this break, so stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. As the Trump administration proposes cutting as much as $5.8 billion from the NIH, as scientists march on Washington to defend their field, you might think it's worth time. It's the worst time for a thoroughly big airing of systemic deficiencies in biomedical research. Well, this is going to be bad time to talk about that, but no. NPR science reporter, science correspondent Richard Harris is airing them anyway. He has a new book out, a terrific new book, about the stories of labs cutting corners, clinical trials based on bad preclinical research, contaminated cell lines, and a consistent failure to find new advances in curing cancer and other major diseases. And with papers in recent years estimating, for example, that as many as 20% of studies may have untrustworthy designs, wasting as much as $28 billion per year. So what should researchers and their institutions be doing differently? Can we criticize science as it's practiced and still advocate for funding it better? Richard Harris, NPR science correspondent, author of the new book, Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. We also have an excerpt of the book at sciencefriday.com/cures. Our number, 844-724-8255. Always good to see you, Richard.
Nice to see you,
Ira. We've known each other like 35, 40 years, something.
It seems forever, yeah.
But I've got to, this is a great treaty. This is a great book. I mean, it's eye-opening, and you don't mince any words in this book about criticizing scientific research. Was it as surprising to you for the years you've covered science?
It was somewhat eye-opening, absolutely. And I must say that, you know, it does have a very gloomy title, and you do raise some very fair questions about whether the timing of this is ideal. But it's not an all bad news book, actually. There's a lot of things that I point out in the book that can be remedied and should be remedied. And I think, you know, we fund a lot of research, we taxpayers, and it's a completely valid question to say,
yes,
are we getting our money's worth?
Yes.
And that was, I went into it with an open mind. I said, sometimes we are, sometimes we aren't. Here's how we can do better.
You talk about, I think, what we as science reporters, we as medical reporters do every week. We open up the journals. We find a mouse study. We talk about the mouse study. We're always careful to say it's a mouse study. It may not apply to humans.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't let the people really know the truth of where that mouse study is eventually headed.
That's true. And a lot of these mouse studies are headed absolutely nowhere. One of the stories that I tell in the book is about the search for treatment for glioblastoma, a terrible brain cancer. And I was in somebody's office, Anna Barker, who's at Arizona State University, what used to be deputy director of the National Cancer Institute. And she had a poster on the wall. And I said, the print is so fine on that poster. What is that? And she said, it's a list of every single study of glioblastoma. There are 200 study names on that list, and every single one of those studies failed. And many of those studies started with hopeful, intriguing ideas from mice that simply didn't translate into human health.
But we won't hear about those failures, will we?
Well, no, but by and large, we may report those first initial, here's something that seems to show promise in mice, and then it sort of fades away from there.
Are we talking about misconduct in research and for many of these cases?
Very rarely, as far as anyone can tell, is there outright fraud and misconduct going on here. What's much more common is that the system that is set up right now, there's such a fierce race for money, and the amount of money that's available is diminishing all the time. It puts incredible pressure on scientists, and they can't afford to have anything less than perfect, or they're worried they'll lose their funding. So what happens is this drives scientists to exaggerate what they're finding and to overstate, to sweeten, to maybe cut a few corners here to try to get their science out the door as fast as possible, because they need that next funding grant. They need promotions. People who are young scientists wanting to get jobs know that they have to have something really spectacular or they can't move ahead. So the incentives are really set up wrong. Nobody wants to spend time on studies that don't pan out, but the incentives are all pointing in the wrong direction.
And you read, again, reading the journals and reading articles about research. I mean, the whole definition of research is search and then research, right? So that you do those experiments over again. But you point out in your book that many of these original experiments are never done again.
Right. Or people do them again and it doesn't work and they give up and they never publish the result. You know, often a graduate student will be told, hey, here's a hot paper. Why don't you build on that finding? But of course, before you build on it, repeat the experiment. And they try and try and try to repeat the experiment and they never can get it to work. And so what do? They say, well, I could waste more time writing up how hard I tried to repeat this experiment and I couldn't make it happen. Or they can say, boss, give me a new project. And so we never see, or we don't often enough see those papers that say, hey, there's a problem here. We didn't resolve it. Maybe somebody else can, but this does not seem to be working.
You mentioned in your book that you were surprised yourself when you started researching and interviewing scientists. You thought you'd get pushback from them, but they didn't. They agreed with you.
Right? I was surprised to the extent that people embrace this as a serious problem and were happy to talk to me. And I'm not just talking about the low-level people in the labs who are grousing about how bad their bosses are. I talked to the head of the NIH. I talked to the...
And he agreed there was a problem, right?
Absolutely. And the top person at the FDA who's in charge of drug approval had some of the spiciest language to offer describing what's going on in academic research, and Nobel laureates and many members of the National Academy of Sciences and so on. I mean, I talked to the top people in this field, and there was a lot of hand-wringing, a lot of concern, and a lot of genuine desire to figure out what's wrong so they can make it better. Because as I say, nobody wants this state of affairs to be this way.
Yeah, it's interesting because you made a distinction when you talked about academic research and corporate research. And you were saying, you know, the corporate research seems many cases to be better because they're not throwing more money away because they're a corporation and what they're doing.
Right. There's two different incentives in corporate research, one of which is absolutely, if it doesn't work, you're not going to make money off of it. So there's an incentive to cut your losses and move on. The other thing is, if you're an academic researcher and you have an idea that you're pursuing, if it turns out it's wrong, it may be very difficult to get money to pursue a new idea. So you're maybe going to stick with an idea that you, in your heart of hearts, knows is not really going anywhere. Yeah. In the corporate world, they say, you know, you're a good scientist. We have a different project for you. Take this one on instead. So I think both of those dynamics are at play.
Mm-hmm. Our number 844-724-8255. We're talking with Richard Harris about a very aptly named book, Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions, and it's out by Basic Books. And, you know, it looks like the National Academy of Science, Academies of Science agree with you. They have a new report out just last week describing what they call detrimental research practices and advocating higher standards. Most scientists in biomedicine obviously acknowledge this problem, as you say. So what is the overarching answer to this? There's no thumbnail answer to this.
No thumbnail answer, but there are a couple of things that can happen, and some can happen quite quickly and quite easily. One thing is that scientists often use poor ingredients, and they can do a lot better job checking their ingredients. In fact, there are new laws requiring that they do a better job of checking to make sure that their cell lines, for example, or what they think they are.
And that's an amazing part of the book. In that part of the book, you say, you know, they've been experimenting with what they thought were cancer cells for years, or one kind of cancer. It turns out it's another kind of cancer.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe that.
There are hundreds and hundreds of cell lines that are misidentified. It is quite remarkable. So that's one thing. You can fix that problem easily. Another thing you can do is you can increase the amount of transparency that's in science. And you can tell scientists, make all of your data available. Make your analytical code, your computer code available so other people can run the code on your data and see if they can get the same answer, and share your ingredients.
They will do that? You know how much
there are some disincentives for doing that because people are worried about the competitive nature of that. But that is often required in various guises, either by journals or by funding agencies. Some scientists ignore that anyway. But the more you can make that happen, the quicker you can close this loop and say, is this a valid result or not? The other actually powerful thing about that is if a scientist says, I know I'm going to have to put all this out there, I'm going to check it one more time because I'd rather find my own mistakes than have somebody else find it. So I think it's not universally done by any means, but I think the more that we can improve transparency in science, the better off we'll be.
You know, scientists always are trying to get into the two or three top journals, Science, Nature, whatever. What is the role of the journals in ensuring that this is a good bit of research here?
Well, actually, they incentivize bad research in a way, because if you know that your promotion is based on getting your paper in Cell, Nature, or Science,
right,
you have to make sure it's as totally squeaky clean as possible. So if you find some data that doesn't agree, maybe I'll leave that out of my paper, because then that may make the editor less likely to accept it. And so this actually turns out to be a pretty serious disincentive for scientists to be totally honest about things. And some of these, there are words that have increased dramatically in the scientific literature in the last 30 years or so. It was extraordinary, unprecedented, so on. Those are increasing in dramatic fashion in the literature, because people want to say, what I have found is so spectacular that I deserve a new grant and maybe a promotion or both. So
or a prize.
Or a prize. So the journals actually leaves the journals on some journals uncomfortable, because actually, if you're a dean and you're trying to decide who to hire, you'll say, well, who's published in the top tier journals? And the journals say, we just pick things that we think are interesting. We don't really mean to be the surrogates for the deans at these schools to decide who's the top scientist. Mm-hmm. Just because you have a paper in a top journal doesn't necessarily mean it's a top result. But it's part of the topsy-turvy system that has evolved.
Speaking of topsy-turvy, let's go to our listeners. Let's take a call. Let's go to Jennifer in Houston. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi there. Thanks. I was wondering if anybody that you'd been talking to during this project mentioned the fact that sometimes the result you publish is not the initial result that you were looking for at the time of grant proposal and that sort of thing. Could it be that any of these poorly designed experiments look poorly designed ex post facto because they were not, in fact, the initial thrust of the research program? They're in a sense, leftover results.
That's an excellent question. And one thing that does happen a lot is people run an experiment, they don't get the result that they expected, and then they say, well, I'm going to come up with a new hypothesis. This is called harking, or hypothesizing after the results are known. And this is a big no-no. It seems commonsensical. Well, if I found an exciting, statistically significant result, you know, what the heck, I'm going to go with it. But it turns out that those are highly likely to be false leads. And scientists are welcome to make those discoveries and observations, but they shouldn't publish them as discoveries. They should say, here's a hypothesis generating discovery. I'm now going to go do a study that's designed to actually look for this effect and see if I can find it in an experiment that is actually designed to look for it. It's a very common and troubling cause of false leads in the scientific literature.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with NPR science correspondent Richard Harris about his new book, Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. And it's a fantastic book. It talks about things you would not have thought of, like how bad at statistics scientists can be. And they're all trying to get that 95% confidence level.
Right, yeah, the p-value of 0.5, right, or 0.0, whatever, 0.05. And a lot of people think that means that their result is 95% chance to be correct, and it's completely not that. It's a little hard to understand. And I mean, I'm a non-scientist. I never really took enough statistics to do this, mm-hmm, but I reviewed this chapter with several really capable biostatisticians to make sure I was on the right track here. But it is easy for scientists to fool themselves and thinking this is a significant result. This is past this magic threshold. Therefore, I can publish it and it must be real. And very, very often, even something that reaches that 95% threshold is just wrong. Statistically speaking, it's a fluke.
What was your turning point? I mean, what got you on to writing this book? Was there something, one particular case you were following and said, oh my goodness, if this is bad, then who knows what the rest of research is like?
There were a number of instances like that. I think the first thing was I was looking at the NIH budget. I came back to reporting on these issues in 2014, and I thought, well, what's been going on? And I discovered the NIH budget had doubled between 1998 and 2003, and then it had flattened out, and in real dollars, it had actually decreased by 20%. And I thought, and I also discovered that there was a 50% increase in the amount of laboratory space in this country to do this kind of research. So I figured, wow, this has got to have some sort of an effect to double the budget, bring in all these new people, open all these new labs, and then gradually cranked down the amount of money that was available. I figured this is going to have some negative consequences. So that was one really big thing. The other paper that really caught my attention was a paper published in 2012 by a researcher named Glenn Begley, who was head of cancer research at the drug company Amgen, and he tried to replicate 53 exciting studies that had been done in academia, and he thought, wow, if any of these work out, these are really great leads for drugs. And of those 53, he could only replicate 6, even with help from many of the original researchers. So that was...
That flag went right up.
That flag was... I was not the only one who noticed that flag, but I think I thought, wow, there's something here that's worth digging into.
You talked about the budget cuts or the decrease in funding for NIH. Now we're going to see even more budget cuts from this new administration, or are we going to see further degradation of research?
It's hard to know what's going to happen right now in Washington, but clearly it's the worst thing you can do if you're in a situation where people are starved for money, and the driving force of what's going on here is that people are fighting harder and harder for less and less money. The solution is not to say, okay, we'll put less money in the pot. I mean, that's only going to make the problem worse.
But you said at the beginning that you don't want everybody to come away from the book thinking the sky is falling, that there are fixes for these things.
Absolutely. And one thing I did spend a lot of time while researching the book doing was tracking down people who've been thinking about these problems and thinking about ways to solve them. And I encountered many people with great ideas. I already mentioned the idea of transparency, but there are a bunch of other ideas that people have for, you know, rethinking the culture of science, for just improving the general situation, for getting people aware of this problem. That's a big factor. And also for improving education, because it starts really in that scientists don't get the kind of training they need. They get on-the-job training. They learn how to do the technical skills, but they don't necessarily learn how to think more deeply about how to design experiments, how to either run the right statistics or find a biostatistician to help them, or those sorts of things.
Well, we're all glad you went back to medical reporting 2014, because this is a great book.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I've read a lot of what you've done, and this, I think, is the best stuff so far. It's Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. It's an eye-opening book by Richard Harris. Thank you, Richard.
My pleasure, Ira.
You're
great to
welcome.
Talk to you.
That's about all the time we have. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York and the folks here at NPR for helping us to get our show on the air this week. If you missed any part of the program and you'd like to hear it again, you can subscribe to our podcast for Science Friday is every day these days, because we're on our website at sciencefriday.com, our smartphones, or tablets, and also you can join our mailing list. We're on Facebook, and we're tweeting all week. Hope to see you at the March for Science tomorrow. I'm Ira Flatow in Washington.